I'm Brad Haynes, Chief Client Strategist and Senior Managing Director of Teneo Australia. If you're joining us for the first time, Teneo is the global CEO advisory firm, working exclusively with CEOs and senior executives of the world's leading companies. Teneo provides strategic counsel across their full range of key objectives and issues. With these objectives and issues in mind, in Australia, we've been focused on the impact of the new Labor government under Prime Minister Anthony Albanese, as this week marks 100 days since the federal election. There's a broad range of issues that any new government has to address. Today, we're looking at three areas: economic policy, public policy, and foreign policy, with three esteemed experts: Danielle Wood, CEO of the Grattan Institute, Paul Kelly, Editor-at-Large of The Australian, and Professor Gordon Flake, CEO of the Perth US Asia Centre. Reflecting on the last 100 days provides us with a view forward to how things may play out in the months and years ahead. So these discussions have brought us significant insights, and we're sure they'll be highly useful to you. Welcome. I'm joined today by Danielle Wood to discuss the first 100 days of the Albanese government. Danielle Wood is the CEO of the Grattan Institute and also leads Grattan's Budgets and Government Program. She has published extensively on economic reform priorities, budgets, tax reform, and generational inequality. She is the president of the Economic Society of Australia and was the co-founder and first chair of the Women in Economics Network. She is also a member of the Parliamentary Budget Office's Expert Advisory Committee and the Commonwealth Bank's CEO Advisory Council. So we are very fortunate to have us join us today. Danielle, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Brad.
Where should the new government be focusing in terms of economic policy development from your and Grattan Institute's perspective as it prepares for its first budget in October 25?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it really is. It's a very challenging set of circumstances, as you point out. It's also a very unusual combination of macroeconomic circumstances. So, frankly, we've come out of COVID in a much better position than I think anyone, rightfully would have expected. The consumer spending is up on pre-COVID levels, including in sectors that were hit really hard, like hospitality. The labour market is, just roaring. Unemployment with a 3 in front, the lowest level in almost 50 years. So you've got, that dynamic on the one hand, and then on the other hand, you've got those points that you were alluding to there, very high inflation, and expected to keep climbing in the next few months and peak somewhere above 7. The government, campaigned on a platform of getting wages growing, but when inflation's that high and wages growth is still picking up, but, overall still running at only about 2.6%, real wages are going backwards. So they do have this very difficult balancing act. And there is only so much governments can do to control macroeconomic circumstances. So I think that's really important to remember. We have the Reserve Bank, which is the front line in macro stabilization policy, doing exactly what they should be doing, which is putting the brakes on demand by moving away from emergency settings in interest rates and moving it back up to something that looks more like a neutral rate setting. So what we need from the federal government in that world is to be working with the RBA, not against. The number one priority in a macro perspective is to be taking heat out of the economy. So that means no stimulus in the October budget. That would be madness. We actually saw some of that in the March budget, and it was absolutely the wrong decision. The fact that everyone was getting checks hitting their bank accounts in July when the economy was running hot is madness. So we do not want to see a repeat of that. We actually want to see some of the heat coming out. And so I think looking at things which are scheduled but not underway, particularly kind of lower value infrastructure spending, I think actually would be a good move from the government. That's an area where there's a lot of capacity constraints and price pressures at the moment. And it feeds into that longer term challenge of budget repair that you were pointing to as well. So at the moment, you know, if we can kind of wind back on spending, take heat out of the economy, it's good for the macro economy, but it's also good for that longer term budget challenge.
It's a pretty complex challenge when you've campaigned on minimising cost of living pressures, and there are some potentially stimulatory measures in Labor's policy program. Do they, I mean, I imagine they feel that they would have to implement those regardless to build the credibility and not suffer, you know, what effectively happened to the Abbott administration in early in their term, where the budget didn't meet those expectations. So I guess your view is they should be looking at other elements in the budgetary program that wasn't necessarily part of their formulation as targeted points to take out. Is that what you're pointing to?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, so there's hard decisions around things like the fuel excise cut, which was only implemented for a period of 6 months. I think it is right to say that that is going to be wound back, but that will hurt household budgets. Other commitments they've made, you know, things like reducing out-of-pocket costs for childcare actually, you know, in terms of the headline inflation number, they bring it down because it's an administered price that goes in there. So it actually improves the inflation situation and is really good for the labour market situation. You know, as we said before, we've got very, very tight labour markets. We do have record high participation rates, but we know that there are still a lot of particularly women with young children that would like to work more if they can find the care and they can afford the care in order to do so. The other challenge in that sector, of course, is finding the workers to provide the care that then enables more women to participate in the workforce. So that one's actually, a positive measure in my mind. But yes, I think they are going to have to be looking for additional areas to pull demand out that hopefully is, you know, not going to be hurting people at the bottom, the ones that are really doing it tough when you've got inflation running high as you do at the moment.
One element of inflation is obviously the expectations game, and the government, in terms of what it says and how it positions, you know, contributes to that expectation game. How do you think the Albanese government is going, particularly when you compare it against other OECD economies? Because inflation is not unique to the Australian economy. In fact, it's considerably worse elsewhere in the Western world, and the OECD as well in particular.
Yeah, that's right. And expectations matter. Again, it tends to be the central bank that sits at the front line of expectations management. And the sense I get from both the RBA and the government is if we don't see a world where wages kind of take off in the next few months and this starts getting baked in, so that's always the risk, the kind of the wage price spiral. People, when they're going to negotiate their next bargaining agreement or wage deal, start to factor in this expectation that inflation might be 5 or 6 or 7%, which then of course feeds into inflation and locks it in at a higher level for longer. If we manage to get through this next period where that doesn't happen, and we're certainly not seeing that happen in the headline figures by any stretch at the moment. We, you know, there's sort of isolated examples of there, people talking about high wage rises, but it's certainly not showing up in the headline figures. Then I think there is a very reasonable chance that we'll see the inflation number come well down next year. So some of the kind of supply side pressures, particularly around things like food prices, are working their way through the chain. Energy prices, of course, you know, really tied with the situation in Ukraine. So that's not clear how that is going to play out. And certainly I think we're going to see some of the demand coming out of the economy, which has been leading to sort of domestic price pressures. So I think, you know, we may well come through this quite smoothly, but, you know, there are external factors at play that will affect that trajectory.
And then just taking that to its logical extension, that seems to suggest that Australia will be able to get through this without a recession. Is that your view at this stage?
I think that's right. So if the path of interest rates plays out as currently the kind of central estimate, which is, the cash rate will peak kind of mid to high twos, then I think we can get through it without a recession. If we end up in the world of the wage price spiral, RBA has to push harder That starts to look a lot messier. That's when you start to see households in, you know, much more financial distress, you know, big impact on demand across the economy. And you know, that's the world, I think, where you're looking more likely to have a kind of recession-like scenario.
One of the missing pieces, and obviously you have deep background in this area, is productivity right across the Australian economy. And this 100 days period that we're talking about coincides with the Jobs Summit. What would you like to see come out of the Jobs Summit in terms of enhancing productivity and prospect, obviously, of, you know, wage growth that's linked to productivity outcomes that are effectively affordable in that?
Yeah, it's such an important question, and I was really delighted to see productivity kind of front and centre in the Jobs Summit issues paper, because as you say, in the long term, you know, productivity is what drives sustainable, healthy wages growth, and it has been in the doldrums. Again, not just an Australian phenomenon, we've seen this right around the developed world, but really the sort of the decade post-global financial crisis, productivity growth been substantially lower than it was in the sort of two or three decades preceding that. This question of how do you get productivity moving is a really hard one. Again, there is a lot outside the hands of government. I think that's worth noting. A lot depends on the pace of technological innovation and the way in which, speed at which we adopt and move our business practices to bring in best practice. Governments can play a role in that. The Productivity Commission just put out a really important report, I think, on the kind of digital revolution and how that can transform, you know, every aspect of the way we do business, the way we provide services like health and education. And, you know, government's role there is really to invest in the enablers. So the skills and training that the workforce needs, things like cybersecurity, which, you know, reduce the risk for businesses playing in this space. So I actually think that's a really important focus that I hope we talk about a lot at the Jobs Summit. There are many other ways in which we can improve productivity. We've done a lot of work on the migration system. And this is not just the kind of debate about the size of the intake. It's about the composition. So at the moment, we in our skilled migration system, we rely on this very outdated system of occupation lists. You know, these bureaucratic documents. You can come in if you're on the list. You can't if you're not. Really bad for sectors like tech, where, you know, they're coming up with new jobs that didn't exist a year ago. Moving just to a simple wage threshold, whereby, you know, higher income, higher skilled workers can come in, you get rid of that kind of bureaucratic red tape, you target the system to those that are going to bring the biggest economic benefits and the sort of spillover benefits for the rest of the workforce, is a really easy reform to do. And you know, we've run the numbers and shown it can make a big difference both to the economic position and the fiscal position. Easy wins that could come out of the Job Summit there.
And if I understand the data correctly in this area, the difference that it makes very substantial in terms of the contribution to the Australian economy doubles when you target, you know, the right composition in terms of migration. Is that what your numbers were showing, sort of a significant advantage in terms of a technically qualified person coming into Australia and contributing to the economy as opposed to the general benefit we get from migration on the aggregate?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, and it does tend to correlate with income level. So income level is kind of a reflection of the broad contribution you're making. Obviously, fiscal contribution, higher incomes, higher income tax levels. So it's quite clear that, you know, that's a much cleaner and more effective way to target the composition of the intake.
What do you think the business community should be bringing forward to the government in this context at the Job Summit in terms of, and, you know, being part of this broader discussion on economic reform in Australia? Because it's probably a more incremental process. I was speaking with Paul Kelly on the overall subject in this regard, and he sees a more incrementalist approach being taken. If that's the case, what are some of the things that you think the business community can come forward that are going to be helpful in this context?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. So I think business have been long interested in this question of the interface with the training system. And, you know, I think the kind of decline in vocational education and training has been of concern for a long time to business. So I think if governments and businesses can find a way to improve the signals that are going back into the training system about the types of skills that, that businesses need, that would be an incredibly important development. It's one that, you know, we've been talking about for a long time, but I think, you know, it's not yet working effectively. I think business will be very involved in the debates on industrial relations, and obviously both businesses and unions are signalling in the lead up to the summit that they would like to see some shifts in the bargaining system and how that works. Whether there is an agreement to be reached there, there's certainly, I think, a broad sense that there would be scope for simplification and speeding up bargaining processes. But at the moment, there seems to be quite a lot of distance between the pre-summit positions of the business and union movement. So whether there's scope to find a kind of mutually agreeable place in the middle, I think remains to be seen.
Yeah, that's absolutely the case. When you look at the budget, I mean, there are some things that are in the budget that maybe made sense a few cycles ago, but less so now. And one of the areas that's in discussion that Grattan has been talking about is the tax cuts and the overall tax take in and of itself as well. Could you sort of give us some thoughts on your perspective on this area about the need for, I guess, tax reform, how you're managing bracket creep, because nominal wages might be going up at a more accelerated point. It's quite a lot of areas to straddle. What should the government be doing in this instance?
Yeah, first thing to say is we are in such a different fiscal world than when those tax cuts were first designed. So, you know, I said it at the time and I'll say it again, it is madness to lock in tax cuts 7 years in advance when you don't know what could happen. And what did happen, we had a global pandemic, a massive recession, and, you know, we come out in obviously a very different budget position. The other backdrop to the discussion, I think, is just the structural budget position. So spending now over the next decade is expected to stabilise considerably higher than when we went into COVID at about 26.3% of GDP compared to 25% of GDP pre-COVID. We've baked in higher spending on things like aged care, on things like defence, the NDIS. We haven't had any discussion about the revenue line or how we pay for this. So it's been sort of head in the stand stuff in the election campaign. So I do think we should reconsider the stage three tax cuts given that environment. My view would be the priority for tax reform, I think, is dealing with leakages to the income tax base. So we have a whole lot of concessions and loopholes that are seeing money leaching out of the base. And then the way we deal with that is let the headline rate creep up over time. So my best case scenario, Brad, would be we still do the stage three income tax cuts, but at the same time, we try and close off some of the leakages. So that would mean winding back some of the excesses of superannuation tax concessions, particularly in retirement. I would reduce the size of the capital gains tax discount, look at things like family discretionary trusts. And if you package that in with the tax cuts, you're significantly reducing the fiscal cost. That still would be a fiscal cost. Most people are still better off. They're still getting some of that bracket creep given back, but you've bought some long-term reform and you've looked, you know, to build the sustainability of that income tax base going forward. So I think that's one option for the government, probably preferable to dumping them altogether, which will just mean that you end up delivering them in 2 or 3 years' time, because eventually you do have to give back bracket creep. But, you know, if you're going to spend a lot of money, buying some reform on the way through, I think makes a lot of sense.
Right way of putting it. The RBA obviously has come under some criticism, and the government's announced a review What do you think should come out of that review in terms of, you know, the way the RBA operates in the future? And was it overly harsh, the criticism, or was it, you know, well judged? Because inflation, it was almost at every central bank, they missed it, missed the same story everywhere else in the world. I mean, how do you calibrate their performance? And then out of that, what should the review be coming up with to make sure it gets optimised or better over time?
So I think there's been two quite distinct criticisms of the Reserve Bank performance. So one is actually the period pre-COVID. So a sense that, you know, they weren't hitting their inflation target. The economy was pretty sluggish. Unemployment was elevated. And so the criticism is they should have actually done more in that period, that interest rates should have been lower because they were consistently and systematically missing targets. The other criticism is, as you say, coming out of COVID. And I think, to be honest, I actually find that sort of the criticism around the COVID response is a little unfair. So yes, central banks and governments around the world threw the kitchen sink at an issue which looked incredibly dire. And you know, the Reserve Bank governor talks about it as an insurance policy, and it was right to take out that insurance, frankly, because the cost of getting it wrong and under-supporting the economy in COVID could have been absolutely devastating, you know, mass unemployment with all the kind of long tail effects that has. So if, you know, if the criticism is they overshot in their support, I think, you know, that's made with the benefit of hindsight. The more valid criticism coming out of COVID, I think, is around the communications and the, you know, what seemed to most people that are not trained in central bank speech to be a very clear signal that we wouldn't see a move in interest rates until 2024 at the earliest, I think led to a sense where a lot of people took that on board or factored it into their decision making and then were quite shocked when we're now seeing, you know, aggressive interest rate increases in 2022. So I think to the extent there is a valid criticism, it's probably around the communication strategy coming out of COVID. So what should come out of the review? So I think the review is very rightly looking at this question of what's the right objective for the bank. And I'm not a monetary policy expert or a macro expert, but the debate is essentially, is the inflation target the right one? There are some people that suggest instead we should be looking at national income growth, or there's different variants of the target. So I'm very glad we've got three deep experts to consider that question. There's also a question of the board composition. So our Reserve Bank board does look at quite unusual by international standards. Mm. So we have the Treasury Secretary on the board is one difference. We have a real focus on business membership of the board and sort of different sectoral interests being represented on the board. Overseas, much more emphasis on people with quite deep academic expertise in monetary policy or macroeconomic policy. And certainly the academic community here has been very strong in suggesting that we do need more people with deep expertise to challenge, to really, you know, the Reserve Bank governor comes, the deputy governor's also on the board. They present the review of the views of the Reserve Bank to that board, but having people on there that are able to kind of test and challenge reduces the likelihood that you end up with sort of groupthink. So I think that's a really important issue for the review. There's also a question of kind of internal culture and has the Reserve Bank been too insular, a related point. So are you actually getting differences of thought coming in? You know, they are an organisation that's kind of famous for growing their own. Not many people come in at the senior levels from outside. My sense is that they are, you know, more actively trying to bring in external voices and challenges within their own processes. But nonetheless, I think it is important for the review to look at it. Very finally, the other thing the review is going to is this interaction between monetary policy and fiscal policy. So even though we're in a world where interest rates are going up at the moment, I think very, very likely we are in just a lower overall interest rate environment in decades to come than we have been in previous decades. The sort of the neutral rate of interest has come down as we see more and more savings around the world. And so that central role that we've had the RBA play in macro stabilisation, it's just less able to manage that. So if interest rates are lower, it's got less scope to move. And then the question is, well, then what role does fiscal policy have in picking up the slack when you've got a big economic shock? So we saw that happen in COVID. We saw very much governments come in and pick up some of that role in stimulus. And the question is, you know, can we have something to say, or can we think in advance about what that looks like going forward? And that's a really hot topic in macroeconomic policy debates around the world right now. And we should be thinking about it in advance, not just kind of, having to make it up on the spot the next time we have a crisis.
Absolutely. And it's a critical area in the formulation of government policy for the sequencing of those two major arms effectively to work in concert with each other. Speaking of working in concert, just I guess one last question. The reviews from the public polls are very strong. Generally, the reviews from a lot of the leading commentators are, in terms of the discussions I've had to date this on this issue, they've also been positive. How are you sort of rating or setting out your observations on the Albanese government's first 100 days, particularly obviously when it comes to the setting of economic policy and their early moves and signals in this area?
Well, 100 days is never very long, but look, I think overall it's a positive review from me as well. I think they've been fairly measured in their, and rightly so, in the way they've sort of talked about macroeconomic conditions. I think they're very cognizant in that role in expectations that we were talking about before. They've shown a very consultative approach. Job Summit, I think, is an example of that. But, you know, so many roundtables and discussions in advance of the summit. So they are really listening and consulting very broadly, which I think is a big tick. And I think they're making the right noises. So as we said, that focus of the summit on questions of productivity as the way to drive stronger wages growth in the long term, I think is a real positive. So it's certainly the sort of the early indications of where they see the economic policy debates and settings going are very positive as well. It's one thing, of course, to say things, it's another thing to deliver. And we know that, you know, big sort of productivity enhancing reforms are challenging to do. But so far, so good, at least on the rhetoric.
That's fantastic. Well, thank you very, very much for your time today, Danielle. I really enjoyed the discussion. I think all our viewers will as well, and appreciate very much you joining us.
Thanks very much, Brad.
Paul is the editor-at-large of the Australian newspaper. He was previously the editor-in-chief of this newspaper and has written extensively as one of Australia's most authoritative commentators on politics, public policy, and international affairs. He has covered Australian governments from Gough Whitlam to the Albanese administration today, a span of some 50 plus years. He is the author of 9 books, including the seminal End of Certainty, the book on 1980s politics and the Hawke and Keating government. His recent books include Triumph and Demise on the Rudd-Gillard era and The March of Patriots, which offers a reinterpretation of Paul Keating and John Howard in office. So we are very delighted to have him here. Thank you, Paul.
Good to be with you, Brad.
Great. And I start with the obvious question. How have the first 100 days gone for the new Albanese government?
They've gone very well, no doubt at all about that. A couple of preliminary points. The government's position is much stronger than its narrow majority in Parliament suggests. This is because the election results saw a narrow Labor win off a weak primary vote, but a very significant defeat for the coalition, reduced to 58 seats in the Parliament, so a much bigger defeat for the coalition than it was a win for the Labor government, essentially because of the Teals. So Labor's position overall is stronger than the numbers in Parliament suggests. Labor believes there's a new mood in the country, a new mood that it characterises by support for diversity, inclusion, compassion and fairness. And what we've seen in recent days is Anthony Albanese really seeking to brand and discredit the Morrison government and the Liberal Party in a way that will last 4 years. The character of the government is not yet established. That takes quite a long period of time. But I would say about that, there are early signs about the character of the Albanese government. I think it's going to be measured in its approach. I would say incremental in terms of policy, anxious to prove its economic credentials, keen to consult and develop consensus positions where it can. It will be faithful to the unions, but it will want to work with business. I think the Prime Minister puts a great emphasis on his mandate. He wants to implement the mandate, but not go too far outside the mandate. And I have to suggest so far, there's a degree of quality about the senior ministers. Everything, of course, depends upon the capability of the Prime Minister. After 100 days, he's doing better than many people expected, but the big tests still lie ahead.
You talk about, obviously, the ugly inheritance of some of your early riding on the new administration. Can you maybe sort of step that out a little about how big that economic challenge is? Because clearly Jim Chalmers, the Treasurer, is a student of history and a student of the Keating government. And one of the key things that the Keating government did was establish themselves early on as superior economic managers. Do you see the same signs here? And how does that very substantial challenge in the high inflation environment we find ourselves in present for the government in trying to take that on?
Well, I think the economic challenge is different to that of previous governments. And I don't think the government is going to be bold in economic policy execution. It essentially faces two fundamental economic challenges. The first one is the inflation challenge. And I think the government will essentially leave that to the Reserve Bank. I mean, we see central banks around the world having to come to grips with inflation. This is essentially a central bank challenge. And in that sense, I think the government will be hostage to the Reserve Bank and hostage to Governor Phil Lowe and his capability to get inflation back to the 2 to 3% target range without inducing a recession. Private sector economists are divided about the capacity to do that. I guess on balance, I think that we should be able to bring inflation under control without falling into recession. But that is a disputed issue. And it, of course, it's a critical one. If the economy was to go into recession in the first term of the new Labor government, then that would be a significant setback. The second challenge is the longer run productivity, living standards, the cost of living challenge. And we know that the single most important issue in the election campaign for Anthony Albanese was cost of living. And we know that he can't do much about that at the moment. So the question is the extent of political tolerance the electorate is going to be prepared to extend to the Albanese government, because it's going to conspicuously fail to deliver on two of its central election commitments. That was to restore real wages and to contain cost of living. And the government's going to have to live with these difficulties over the course of the rest of this year and well and truly into 2023. At the same time, it's going to have to put in place a series of longer run measures designed to increase productivity, increase real wages and increase living standards. And the test for the government on that front will come further on down the track. The budget will be very important, but the way I see the budget, I think the budget will essentially implement the main election commitments in relation to begin to implement the spending commitments on childcare and aged care. The Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, has made it clear it will cut back spending rorts from the Morrison government. How far the government goes in terms of cutting back spending to bring fiscal policy into alignment with monetary policy is a moot point. As I said earlier on, I don't think this is going to be a draconian budget. I don't think this is going to be a big reforming budget. The government will talk up its reforms, but I think the nature of this government will be that it is an incrementally reforming government. And when Albanese talks about two terms, I think that means he's learnt the lesson from the Abbott government. We're not going to see an opening budget like that of the Abbott government.
How does Labor implement its full agenda beyond legislating a target in climate change with the centre-left bias, given that they didn't necessarily win big numerically, the centre-left did, and that will be the key bargaining by which any of the measures which they're seeking to implement will actually turn into policy?
Well, I think these are good points. I think that the climate change policy and political debate will, to a large extent, be a debate on the left of politics. What happened at the election was the country moved to the left. In as much as the election was a win for Labor, the Greens and the Teals, and in as much as they all ran on a climate change agenda, and there are very significant differences between these groups on their climate change agenda. I mean, the actual differences between Labor and the Greens on climate change are simply enormous. So we're seeing this shift to the left, and we're seeing the electorate vote for more action on climate change, but there's a very substantial gulf when it comes to what these policies actually are. Now, the government has had a very significant victory with its climate change bill. There's no doubt about that. Getting the 43% into legislation, daring down the Greens, making a few token concessions to keep the Teals happy. But the interesting thing here is that Adam Bandt, the leader of the Greens, having made this concession and having felt that he had no option but to vote for Labor's climate change bill, Adam Bandt has doubled down on both climate change and the economy and put a succession of green demands on the table. And in particular, of course, we know the main one, and that's no further development of fossil fuels, coal and gas. We know Labor rejects that. So we are going to see very intense ongoing pressure from the left, from the Greens and the Teals, on the Labor government. And the interesting thing will be how it responds to this pressure. Now, Anthony Albanese and Chris Bowen had a major win staring down the Greens on the actual climate change bill. But it'll be more difficult, I think, for them to protect their left flank and stare down the Greens and the Teals when they demand more action on climate change. Now, the political reality here is that Albanese and Bowen are acutely aware of the risk of being seen to make concessions to the Greens. And if they do that, and that is perceived by the electorate, and that's what Peter Dutton is waiting for, Peter Dutton is waiting to be able to depict this Labor government as being a Labor-Green government. He's waiting to depict Labor as being in hostage to the Greens. And of course, he will reinforce this with the fact that Labor cannot meet its election commitment to cut energy bills.
Do you think, you mentioned about the economy and taking their time, do you get the sense that they'll take more time on these measures rather than try and implement these things together as a single package?
If you look at Chris Bowen, he's pretty determined. He's pretty committed and he's fairly aggressive. And one of the points he argues, of course, is that there's not much time between now and 2030. He likes to recite the number of months between now and 2030. So I think Bowen is keen to move. The other point I'd make about the government is the government has got a pretty broad consensus for its position. It's got the support of most business and industry groups, got the support of the Business Council, it's got the support of the Australian Industry Group, Farmers Federation, the ACTU, all the green groups. And of course, it's got the support of state governments, which have, by and large, 50% emissions reduction targets by 2030, more ambitious than Labor's 43% target. So that's a pretty good political framework for Albanese and Bowen to work in. The big question is how the public feels about this, how the public responds. And essentially, you've got two contradictory factors at play here. One is that there's support for Australia to do more on climate change, but the electorate is going to be sensitive to price rises, and we know energy prices, power prices are going to go up. And so the question then becomes one of the tolerance of the community for these sorts of changes.
Absolutely. One of the other early characteristics I think you could say about this government is its discipline and its organisational coherence, at least in its first forms. Do you agree with that perspective? Is that something that you've noted? Is the public responding to that sort of organisational discipline as an entity, particularly when it's juxtaposed against the revelations regarding the Morrison government and the secret ministries?
Couple of points here. I think the Morrison government was a tired government. It suffered from a lot of internal divisions. And Albanese is acutely aware of this and has put a lot of emphasis on process and discipline and order. And of course, he's just reinforced that given the revelations in the past fortnight about Scott Morrison being commissioned into these five other portfolios. So this, in a sense, if you like, this just reinforces where Albanese was anyway. I think that a really important point, which doesn't get enough emphasis, is a lot of these senior ministers are veterans from the Rudd-Gillard period. And they've drawn the lessons from the Rudd-Gillard period. And the lessons were that process wasn't good enough. You had an interventionist prime minister who tried to do too much. You had too many internal divisions. You had a fundamental rivalry over the leadership. And that Labor's got to correct for the Rudd-Gillard stakes if it's to govern effectively. This is a deeply held view. And the point I'd make is I think there's a lot of talent on the Labor front bench. Sure, they're untested, but they've been in Parliament for some time. They've learnt a lot. Albanese, of course, is a veteran. He's been there for a very long period of time. I think they're pragmatic in spirit. They're measured in outlook. They're prepared to take decisions. They want to govern for the long haul. They're not interested in achieving a few big wins in the first few months and thinking job done. That's not where they are. So I think all these are important points. Now, everything depends upon the performance of the Prime Minister. So far, he's done very well. The point I'd make is that halfway through the last term, there was a significant debate in the Labor Party about the need to replace Anthony Albanese as leader because there was a concern that he was likely to lose the election that he subsequently won. We know politics can change. Albanese is showing a prime ministerial capacity after 100 days that surprised many people. And that's to be welcomed. That's to be welcomed. I think he will govern more, if we've got to make these comparisons, more like Bob Hawke and less like Kevin Rudd. Hawke delegating, using cabinet to take the decisions, trusting his ministers, giving them some scope, and being careful about implementing the agenda. Well, business has got a big opportunity with this government because the Prime Minister has made it clear that wherever possible, he'd like not just to consult, but to develop consensus positions. So that is a big opportunity. And the interesting thing here is what might be the nature of those consensus positions. Is this just a pipe dream, or might it be achievable? Well, the Prime Minister would clearly like to achieve it. So in that sense, I think we can see opportunities for the business community. Business has got to be realistic. I mean, this government is not going to turn around and start implementing the chapter and verse of the Business Council of Australia agenda. But the Business Council didn't get all its way with the previous government. We're well and truly aware of that. And I think that this new government wants to deal in good faith with business and to be seen to be doing that. So I think there are opportunities there. We'll see how the summit goes.
Professor Flake is the founding Chief Executive Officer of the Perth US Asia Centre at the University of Western Australia. He's one of the world's leading authorities on strategic developments in the Indo-Pacific, with extensive experience across the US foreign policy community focused on the Korean Peninsula and Northeast Asia, and now 8 years in Australia's Indian Ocean capital in Perth. Professor Flake has authored many scholarly and policy studies on security developments in the region. He's a sought after media commentator at the leading Australian international media outlets, and he also holds a number of significant strategic leadership roles, including as governor at AmCham, the Australian Chamber of Commerce in Australia, and is a board member of the US Studies Centre at the University of Sydney. And he's a member of the International Advisory Board of the David M. Kennedy Centre at Brigham Young University. It's quite an extensive range of experience, and we're very lucky to have Professor Flake join us today. Hi, Gordon, and thanks for joining us.
Brad, it's my pleasure. Good to have the conversation, albeit virtually.
Now, you're joining us from Perth and the beautiful campus of UWA. I'm assuming it's a sunny day where you are, and this is technically your third Australian political administration, or fifth if we count prime ministers. How has this first 100 days gone for the new government in foreign and strategic policy from your perspective?
Well, look, the centre which I have the honour of running, the Perth US Asia Centre, is by design and by intent nonpartisan. And this is the first time I've actually seen a change of government on a national level. I arrived in January of 2014, January 1st to be exact, shortly after the Liberal National Coalition came into power. So really, this is kind of a first for me, a chance to kind of witness the change in government in Australia. And there are several things that make me quite optimistic that really have nothing to do with partisan politics. A lot of it has to do with the system. We're accustomed in the last several years to being increasingly concerned about the state of democracies globally. And we've seen in my homeland, in the United States, in the United Kingdom, and elsewhere, individuals attempt to kind of hold on to power. But this last federal election gave me great cause for hope about the Australian system. Number one, we saw several campaign tactics, both racially tinted ones, ones that kind of tended to more polemically or divisive issues like transgender issues, fail to be kind of rejected by the body politic. We saw attempts to kind of bring intelligence collection and interpretation into kind of the partisan arena, and we saw that kind of rejected by our civil servants and by the broader community in a very helpful way. And then on a very positive way for the outgoing government, we saw an election result which, to be honest, could have been disputed, at least could have been delayed in terms of the acceptance. And the fact that the outgoing government, in particular outgoing, are now outgone, Prime Minister Scott Morrison made the decision, despite the fact that a number of seats had been called, to concede the election and to make all the necessary preparations that were required to get our now Prime Minister Anthony Albanese into Tokyo on his first full day in office to attend a leaders meeting of the Quad, again, was pretty encouraging. It showed country before party, and it showed the robustness, all of these things I'm talking about, of our democratic system here in Australia. So there's plenty for us to be pleased about. More broadly, I think what we've seen is an Australian government now, under the new government, that is much more in sync with the democratic administration in the United States, but also much more in sync with many of our regional partners. And so I thought it was really encouraging in such a short period of time, again, day one, to be in the presence of the leaders of India, Japan, the United States, and to have not only our prime minister there, but our foreign minister there. Shortly thereafter, to have all important meetings of the prime minister in Indonesia, several trips to the South Pacific, to have the foreign minister herself, not just in Tokyo, but three separate trips to the South Pacific, three separate trips to Southeast Asia, to have the deputy prime minister not only speak at the Shangri-La dialogue in Singapore, but to pay an important visit to India and to attend the CHOGO meetings in Africa, all within a very compressed period of time. So there was this sense of not just a return to normal, if you speak, but a very proactive, positive international engagement agenda, which obviously has been recognized by the Australian body politic. We've seen a lot of polls come out in recent days that indicate there is a pretty broad recognition that the country is, at least in terms of foreign policy, on a track that is welcomed by the Australian public. So yeah, interesting 100 days in foreign policy.
That's an extraordinary amount of activity in what is a fairly short period of time. The cliche is to hit the ground running, so to speak, in a new administration, and clearly they have. Why was it important to get to that Quad meeting and represent Australia there so soon into the term of the new office?
So I guess the foreign policy term is to hit the ground flying, or actually you don't want to hit the ground. How do you work on that one? Look, not only does Australia have a very important alliance relationship with the United States, but the Quad leaders meeting has emerged as one of our most important international fora. And if you think about it just for a second, the United States with 360 million people, Japan with 110 million people, third largest economy in the world, India, with 1.3 billion people, it looks like now the largest population in the world, right? Yeah, surpassing China probably this year. These are major countries. And the fact that Australia is at least in this context, a peer with those three countries, really says a lot about our role in the Indo-Pacific. Anyone who has an Indo-Pacific strategy or a broad strategy for the merger of the Asia-Pacific and the emerging important Indian Ocean region kind of recognizes the pivotal geographic position that Australia occupies, but the capabilities that we have in that front. And so again, those are the kind of meetings you can't miss. It's important for our alliances. It's important for our key economic partners like Japan, and it's important for key future partners like India. So to be there, again, hats off to all sides of Australian politics for making this happen. The Quad Leaders Meetings was begun, on a virtual level in March of 2021, and it's continued to have in-person meetings now for this third time. So it's a very positive development, and one I think that all Australians should be proud of and embrace.
It was an incredible turnaround. Why do you think Labor has put foreign policy so high on its agenda? I mean, is there a new normal there where it's unavoidable, or is it just driven by the circumstances of this particular occasion and this particular period?
Well, look, it's not surprising that, after probably the first month or so, there was predictable grousing about, why are our politicians, splitting away on flights elsewhere instead of taking care of problems at home? But the problems at home they were focused on all had their fundamental origins in foreign policy. So you really can't talk about inflation in Australia without talking about the war in Ukraine. And obviously it was good to have our prime minister, in the region to attend the NATO summit, to have the meetings he had in that region, the visit to Ukraine, to kind of emphasize the role that Australia is playing in global peace and security. You can't talk about our economy at home without talking about us being on the receiving end of very overt economic coercion from our largest trading partner in China, and the importance of us looking to diversify. And so those relations with India are really important, and with Japan are very important, and with our alliance partner, the United States, are very important. And obviously, so many of the other issues we're dealing with at home as well, the pandemic. You can't solve the pandemic alone, right? By its very nature, they are global. Climate change. You can't solve climate change alone. There are really no internal solutions that are only held in Canberra. And I think that's not necessarily a partisan issue. It's not traditionally one would presume that if you believe the rhetoric, that a Labor government would be more inward looking and more focused on domestic policy. The reality is that is not the world we live in today. And I think it really is the requirements of the era and the recognition of the current government that the requirements of the era require a proactive foreign policy, because foreign policy is domestic policy.
It takes us to China. And obviously, one of the early things the Albanese government has said is it seeks stabilization in the relationship with China and clearly is trying to inject a new tone. How is this relationship, in your view, tracking right now? With regard to those concurrent objectives?
Look, there was very early on a lot of temperature-related analogies applied to the relationship with China. And the hope was from a lot of parties that there would be a thawing in the relationship, right? And actually, I think that's probably the wrong temperature analogy. I think what I saw rather than a thawing in the relationship, because the underlying issues in the relationship remain unchanged, regardless of which party is in power in Australia. And those go to, again, China's extra legal, use of economic coercion against the United States for political purposes, abusing the rules of the World Trade Organization, targeting Australia for political reasons using trade and other economic mechanisms. Those are unchanged. On top of that, ongoing questions about Xinjiang, about Hong Kong, and most recently Taiwan, those are unchanged, and that's not going to be a partisan issue in Australia. So again, there's not been a thaw in the relationship. What I would describe it as, again, going back to the temperature analogies, it's just lowering the temperature, right? And we did see that, right? There's an opportunity for a bit of a reset, no fundamental change in positions, but not deliberately being provocative on either side and raising the temperature as we had in the past. Here, however, I would make a really important thing for Australian listeners in particular to pay attention to, is it's not about us. I mean, it's really important to set the Australia-China relationship in a broader global context. And again, just 2 weeks ago, everybody in Australia was captivated by a press conference given at the National Press Club by the Australian ambassador to Australia. But his words were no different than the same words given by the Chinese ambassador to France or the Chinese ambassador to Washington, D.C. And we live in a world today where the Canadians, you know, the nicest people on the planet, have some real issues with China, as do the Swedes, as do the Indians, as do the Indonesians, our near neighbors, as do the Vietnamese, as do really pretty much any country, even those countries that are functionally bought and paid for, you know, Laos or Cambodia and the others, have some fundamental issues about transparency, about the corrupting nature of that. And so, again, I think it's really important for Australia to place our relationship with China in a broader global trend, a broader global context, because it isn't just about the particular nuances of what we said and when we said it. It's part of some fundamental policy decisions made in Beijing and how we continue to assert our own national interests in that context. And in that regard, we are not outliers.
Mm. And Southeast Asia, as you mentioned, is also having to reposition to the challenges. Where's Australia's role in that?
Australia has, by dint of geography and by dint of our history, deep and longstanding relationships in Southeast Asia. And so much so that, you know, our treaty ally, the United States, continues to rely upon South Australia for advice on Southeast Asia and to leverage our influence. I think it's of note, and, you know, your listeners will have already sussed out there's a lot more Arizona in my accent than Australia. But having spent 25 years in D.C. before moving to Australia, nearly 9 years ago now, my views on Southeast Asia are much more heavily influenced by a decade here than 2.5 decades there, just because of proximity and the power of proximity. Even today, under the Biden administration, you know, they continue largely to overpass, overlook, and ignore Southeast Asia. We don't have that luxury. And so I was really enheartened to see, and this is one of the, again, if we're talking about the first 100 days, one really important course correction that was made by the Albanese government was the reestablishment of the central focus, or the centrality in our focus on Southeast Asia. So trips by Foreign Minister Wong, not just to Indonesia, but to Vietnam and to Malaysia and to Singapore, really speak volumes about how important our near neighbors are in that part of the region. And obviously, whether it's South China Seas, whether it is supply chains, whether it is pandemics, whether it's climate change, Australia has traditionally been a natural partner with that part of the region. And our relative influence in the Quad, our relative influence in AUKUS, our relative influence with the United States as a treaty ally, all of those things in some part, you know, are based upon our strength in this, our region, you know, the kind of the heart of the Indo-Pacific, if you will.
In India and Australia celebrate their 75th anniversary, obviously, of India-Australia diplomatic relations. And the Perth US Asia Centre put out an excellent joint report looking at the next 75 years of the relationship. I guess a small portion of that will be the next 2 to 3 years. What do you think the Albanese administration should be prioritising? And what have they got right in the first 100 days?
Look, India is one of the relationships where there's far more continuity than change. You know, again, on Southeast Asia, there was a real need for a course correction. I think Southeast Asia was significantly underdone in the previous government in Australia, and we began to correct that. India was very well handled by the previous government, and I'm really encouraged to see this remarkable continuity. And so I would continue to say more of the same, more cooperation of the Quad, more military exercises together, more investment delegations. Looking at it from a Western Australian perspective, it's been really encouraging to have not only the Indian Trade Minister Goyal visit here about 3 months ago, but just 2 months ago or a month and a half ago to have their Mines Minister, Minister Joshi, visit. Had a great meeting with Madeleine King, who you may know is our Resources Minister. I will lay a little bit of personal claim in that Madeleine was the founding COO of the Perth US Asia Centre, my colleague for my first 2 years here, and takes either the responsibility or the blame, depending on how you look at it, for my recruitment coming from Washington, D.C. But Madeleine and Minister Joshi, you know, inked a very important agreement on critical materials. And I think for the first time ever, we're seeing a real establishment of a resources backbone in the relationship, which hasn't existed before. So in a nutshell, Indian interest in Australia, post-Quad, post-AUKUS, with concerns about supply chains and critical materials and future industries and hydrogen and lithium batteries is through the roof. And at the same time, Australia, with a post-economic coercion era, recognizing finally the need to diversify, is more interested than India than ever before too. So there's a remarkable coincidence there that is really encouraging. And I again, I'm optimistic, not just for the next 2 to 3 years, but for decades to come.
What are the main trajectories, or where do you see the priorities of the Albanese? We've covered a lot of territory because they've covered a lot of territory. What's the pathway, and what are the key issues that we should be looking out for as they mature their approach as a new government?
Look, I actually think we've already set the pace pretty well in terms of diplomacy, and I anticipate with that there will be a continuation, right? More continuity than anything fundamentally different, right? You don't need to reset something that's kicked off in the first 100 days very, very well. So I would say more and more of the same, right? Which is good. Right? That's exactly what we want. Maintain the pace. It's pretty clear that there's some work to be done on the security space. It's been a year almost since we announced AUKUS, and one could ask the question, all right, really impressive. This trilateral agreement between the US, the UK, and Australia, but what have we done differently? What have we changed? What's new, right? And so far, we're not quite there yet. It's been over 2 years since we were fortunate at the Perth US Asia Center to host then Minister of Defense Linda Reynolds when she launched the 2020 Defense Strategic Update here in Perth. That update said we've got rapidly reduced planning time, planning horizons. We're not purpose built for the era in which we live. And yet, when you start asking questions, okay, so what have we done in the last 2 years? There is some real anxiety that the pace of change is happening much faster than our decision-making capabilities are keeping pace with that pace of change. And so I was encouraged to see another close friend of the center's, a member of our board, former Defense Minister Stephen Smith, appointed along with Sir Angus Houston, former Chief of the Defense Force, to lead a defense strategic review. I think it's a really important enterprise in the current era. We have 2013 defense white paper, 2016 defense white paper, 2020 defense strategic update. But again, I think one, looking at the world around us, gets the sense that the normal pace of activities isn't sufficient for this era. And so that's an area where I think we're going to have to do a lot more. And then obviously on the broader economic front, our institutional mantra since the day one of our creation was diversify, diversify, diversify. We made an institutional decision on day one not to focus on China, not out of any antipathy towards China or any myopia about the importance of China to Australia's economy. We get all of that. Our view was just that everybody and their dog was just doing China, 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 and nobody was paying attention to those really important relations in Japan and Korea, in ASEAN more broadly, Vietnam, Indonesia, as well as in India. So we opted to focus on that region. And yet, it really wasn't 2 years ago when we were getting no traction in boardrooms in Australia about that diversification mandate. The narrative was always the same, oh, it's too hard, and they're corrupt. And we didn't factor into our risk matrix in Australia the price of market concentration. Today, nobody has that luxury, right? Today, I think there is a broad recognition of the need to diversify. And the good news is that every other country realizes it at the same time. So we're not left entirely to our own devices. I'm really encouraged to see the level of Korean, Japanese, Southeast Asian, Vietnamese, Indian, European interest in Australia has grown dramatically. And one thing that we have done historically well, and I put my Australian Royal We hat on here, is we have really responded well to external demand, external pressures. And so that's an encouraging sign. I'm not entirely confident in our ability to fundamentally reorganize ourselves internally, absent that, but that's a good sign.